Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is Polly Braden. Polly is a documentary photographer who works on long-term projects that often focus on groups of people who are not normally in the media spotlight. For example, in Out of the Shadows, she spent years working with McIntyre, a charity that looks after people with learning difficulties, taking intimate photographs of some of them in schools, homes and day centres. Another series, Holding the Baby, concentrated on some mothers bringing up their children as single parents in a period of austerity. Her works depict everyday life in an intimate and often moving way within a broad political and social context. She's photographed a worker called Ho Ping in a Chinese shoe factory, patients at a flying eye hospital in Africa, the City of London in lockdown, and many others, often highlighting small, often unconscious but telling gestures. Polly won the Guardian Young Journalist of the Year back in 2002 and the Gerwood Photography Prize the year after. Her works have been exhibited around the world, and her latest show, entitled Leaving Ukraine, follows the personal stories of some of the women who have fled to Europe to escape the war there. It's showing at the Foundling Museum in London, which is where I caught up with her. Polly, welcome to the podcast. Nice to meet you.
Very good to meet you. Thank you.
First of all, Polly, what first interested you in photography?
Well, actually, when I was about 19, I lived in East London, and I went to a place called Camera Works that was a dark room, and I started making prints there, and I had a really good atmosphere, a really, really good group of people, and I got an old camera, started taking pictures, and then people in Camera Works would show you how to print. Then I was at the University of East London, and at my university there was a poster saying Teach in China, British Council, and they sent 20 people for the first time ever in 1994 to China for a year to teach at universities. And I took with me a little black and white darkroom. And I spent the year teaching in the mornings, taking pictures in the afternoons, and listening to the World Service and printing all evening.
And is that where you came across Ho Ping?
Yes, Ho Ping, yeah. Well, actually, that was a few years later. I went back and did a story in a factory where I followed Ho Ping.
She worked in a shoe factory, didn't she?
Yes, she worked in a shoe factory in the south of China with 9,000 workers. And I followed her for a couple of weeks doing her work, making shoes for Clarks and Nine West. I wanted to do a story where, in fact, it's probably the first story where I started working this way, where I went somewhere, engaged with someone specifically, and told a sort of wider story through her and a couple of the other girls in the factory. And the factory were very nice. I went around the south of China knocking on factory doors saying, can I come and live in your factory for a few weeks to tell a story in 1996? And they all said, no. And then one factory said, yes, okay, sure, come stay here and do what you like.
And what did you learn about China in that time?
I had been to China once when I was 18. I'd been to three factories with somebody else. And then when I went to live there for a year, it was the first time where I really, after a year, thought, it's so interesting to get to know somewhere because you come in with first impressions, and by the time you've left a year later, everything, all your preconceived ideas are different.
In what way?
Well, I suppose even just the idea that they're different is really important because it shows you that you just can't get under the surface of something very quickly. And the idea that your whole perception of somewhere will change when you get to know it. And it's little things like the fact that you get to know a sense of humour, the fact that you might think that people are a certain way when you first meet them, but it changes. This idea of not knowing something well in the first instance and really not knowing it at all in the first instance really stuck with me there.
Is that where you decided then that documentary photography was for you?
Well, I took pictures every day. I'd go out on my bicycle taking pictures, and then I would develop my film and make prints every afternoon. And at the end of that year, I thought, okay, is there a career? I had no idea there was a career in photography. So I thought, is there a career? And I came back and I started assisting photographers. And I worked in a darkroom for 2 years, a colour darkroom. And then I went to London College of, well, it was called London College of Printing at the time, LCC now. And I did a year photojournalism course, a master's.
Having done a photojournalism course, were you thinking about photojournalism or even just working for a newspaper or whatever?
Yeah, I actually won the Guardian Young Photographer of the Year award that year. So I got some work experience at the Guardian and then I started doing work with them.
And why didn't you carry on working for the press?
Well, I think I really loved working with the Guardian. I would have worked with them all the time. But I am a very slow worker. I used to go and have to photograph someone. I remember going to this Chinese herbal shop and you're meant to go in, take the picture and then go to the next shop. And Roger Tooth kept saying, Polly, you're too slow, because I always wanted to chat to the people and get to know them. And yeah, that was my problem. I was just too slow. So I started working for the magazines so you could spend a bit longer with people.
Well, then you spent 2 years working with McIntyre, a charity that works in the field of autism and people with learning difficulties. What was the attraction of working on that series?
Well, I think, again, it was an opportunity to spend time with people. And I started off, their initial brief was, can you go to some of our homes and photograph? The idea is that the person with the learning disability or autism can do whatever it is they can do to the best of their ability. So if it's pouring a cup of tea, photograph them pouring the cup of tea, not the support worker pouring the cup of tea. So I went around to their houses and kept photographing people with autism learning disabilities making cups of tea. And I went back to them and I said, listen, it's really difficult to make good pictures if we work like this, because kitchens are not very often photogenic. Often people have their back to the camera with the kind of pictures that you want. Can I work on different kind of shoots? Can I talk to them about stuff they're interested in? And can we go out and get more interesting pictures? So, for example, there was a woman called Lucy. A whole group, they went swimming. So I found out that they went swimming. I then started to ask them what they like doing in their own time. And I spoke to a group and they like swimming. So I put my camera into a very rudimentary plastic bag, sort of underwater camera bag, and went swimming with a group of them. And there was a woman called Lucy, and I photographed her diving down underwater. And we had this beautiful picture of her underwater. And things started to get better. And then I just got more and more into the whole project, and I always wanted to go back. So, for example, there was a guy called Mikey, who I met at the very beginning, and I asked if I could go back and see him again and see him again. So it was a project that maybe wasn't always meant to be that long, but the more I got into it, the more I wanted to tell. And then we managed to get a show at the National Media Museum, and Dowie Lewis published the book, and yeah, it just grew.
And you had another follow-up book, didn't you, called Out of the Shadows.
Yeah.
What was the difference between that and the previous one?
Well, so what happened was, what I grew to understand was that the young men who were going from childhood services to adult services, who maybe had learning disability or autism or both, that they were being picked up with McIntyre. And these were very volatile young men often, who were very misunderstood. But they were at a level where they would get the support. But what I kept thinking was, well, what happens to the men, who, or women, but men particularly, who might be just not quite in such a bad situation, who then need specialist care or are misunderstood? So I started to research prisons, and it turns out that, I can't remember what the exact figure is now, about 13% of our prison population has a learning disability. So then I started speaking to Prison Reform Trust, and I spoke to Multistory, who found money through Arts Council to pay for us to do a project, and we followed 10 people with a learning disability through who'd been through the criminal justice system.
And again, how did you approach that photographically?
Well, again, it was through time, getting to know people. One boy, we never ever photographed him. We only photographed his mum, so we told the whole story through his mum. Another man we couldn't identify, so it's only the back of his head. I worked with the writer Sally Williams for that work. And then other people, like some of the other people, we just slowly got to know them and we'd find out what they liked doing. We'd spend more time with them. We'd ask them what they wanted to do in the pictures. So slowly, slowly.
Hmm. I noticed that you use a double photograph technique every so often. Okay. You take two photos more or less of the same scene, but sequentially.
Well, I tell you what that's about, is that often people with a learning disability, I feel, get fixed in a certain... So people see them and they fix them as that is all that you can do. This is you. And so I wanted to use the technique of using several pictures to not distill someone in one moment, to have a thought around the idea of these are people with complex, multiple complex beings, because it's one of the problems is not being able to imagine them being able to do more. And if you can't imagine, then you treat people in a certain way, and then you're not able to reach for your highest possibilities, for your full potential.
Right. So give me an example of where you've done that.
So, sometimes it's through going back over several years. So, for example, Mickey, he is nonverbal, he has autism and learning disability, and he found it very hard at the beginning when he moved into a new home. But he settled after some time. So I wanted to go back when he was more settled and see him out on a bus, for example. So the first time I photographed him doing some activity, and then I went back and photographed him on a bus. It's just to try not to get fixed with one image of someone.
Then you did a project called Holding the Baby. Now, this was all about single parents and who and the problems that they face with economic austerity. Again, what attracted you to that?
Well, I became a single parent, and I was quite struck by the idea that the person who stays is the person who gets essentially punished by the state, that the person who leaves can just go and live their free life. And the more that you started to research, the more you understood the multiple layers of problems. There's a two-child limit in the UK, and also... just suddenly lots of reports were coming out. So I just wanted to dig into that whole issue, to look into it further, to try to express how the parent who stays is doing the best they can potentially that they might be carrying. Imagine this, okay? So imagine if you and your husband have three kids. Imagine if he dies, you're then left with three kids who might be mourning their father. You might have to go into Universal Credit because your income is too low. Your third child will get no child benefit because of the two-child limit. You are looking after two other grieving children. And now when your youngest child is three, you have to go out to work 30 hours a week. Hmm. I mean, it's not easy.
And was one of your case studies one such mother?
Well, one of the women called Gemma, her and her husband had decided to have three kids together. And she was a university administrator, and her husband had left to be with another woman. So it wasn't even that he had died, but he had left, he'd moved to a different city. She was the one who's left, stayed with the kids, and she was struggling to keep the house, struggling to keep her job. She had to work more and more hours, and she had no money for the third child.
Mm. Did you say she was Jana?
She's called Gemma. There's a woman called Jana who I followed as well.
All right, let's talk about Jana.
So Jana I met... during lockdown. She is from Bangladesh. She'd come over to England with an arranged marriage. Her to-be husband had said that she could study when she got here. She was 19 when she came over. Then with him, he then refused to let her go and study. He refused to wear contraception. She got pregnant twice, and then he abused her and was taking drugs. And she escaped, went to a refuge. I met her in a refuge in Islington. And Jana was just really struggling. She had no housing, and at the same time she managed to get herself into university, and she is now in her third year at Imperial College, bringing up her two kids on her own, and she's in her third year doing material sciences at Imperial. I mean, she's super cool.
Oh, that's nice.
And Jana liked to take her kids out, so we often would speak about where she would take the kids out on the weekends, and we worked together to find locations.
Right, and there was another one called Barbeline.
Barbeline, yeah, Barbeline's great with her son. She's doing pretty well now as well. Again, She was very photogenic. I also, some of the pictures I'd take is of her on her way to work, or I often like to photograph the women at work, so it's not just them with the kids, because these are all working women.
Yeah, and she designs clothes, doesn't she? Because there's a picture of her with her son Elijah actually sewing one of her designs, I think.
Yes, yeah.
There's another one you did called, that was always about the flying hospital Orbis. This is where they have an airliner that goes around to certain parts of the world with eye surgeons and eye specialists on board. And you followed them, didn't you?
Yeah, I've been on about 4 trips with them over the years, over about 20 years. And they work with surgeons from the Moorfield Eye Hospital. And they're a great organisation. So I try to tell little stories of people whose eyes have been improved with their help, but also the bigger story of the plane that they run, where they train doctors worldwide. As one surgeon is doing the work in, say, Ethiopia, the patients come onto the plane, and then they have video cameras, and students around the world can watch as they do the work that they're doing.
Oh, right. So, you went to Accra in Ghana and met some young lad called Prince.
Yes. So he was at a football academy, and a young man who worked at the football academy heard about the Flying Eye Hospital, Orbis, and he brought the boy to the hospital. And because I like the stories, I met this young boy and heard that he was at a football academy in Accra. And I heard that they had found him on the streets of Accra playing football, and he'd been picked up and taken to this football academy. So I said to Orbis, can I go and follow this boy back to the football academy where he...
Did he have an eye problem then?
So he came to the hospital because one eye was completely blind, but he was playing football still, which is kind of remarkable because a ball takes 3D vision. So they operated on him, and he would be able to see by the end of that week in that left eye,
So, as a photographer, you would take him playing football, say, or at school, or...
I mean, I still would like to go back and photograph him again now. You know, in my heart, every time I meet someone, I want to see what happens next year and the year after, and to see the progress of a story.
And did you film or shoot his operation?
Yes, I photographed his operation as it was happening. And then I went with the football academy and him back to the football academy, where he lives.
Well, maybe you can follow up when he gets signed up for Arsenal or Chelsea or Tottenham.
Lots of the boys from the football academy in Accra do go and play for the big clubs, And now that academy, I just heard, because actually I met someone who worked there just a few months ago, they're now taking female football, young women, because women's football's doing so well, they're now taking young women.
Oh, that's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a story.
Okay, another one of yours is London Square Mile.
Yes.
This is the city of London that you've photographed, and you've called it a secret city. So what secrets did you discover?
Well, I think that lots of people who live in London don't really realise that the Square Mile is a separate jurisdiction, has its own planning laws, has its own police. The Queen has to ask permission to go into the City of London. So it's secret in that we just don't really realise it's there a lot of the time. I think you pass through the city and you realise it is different to the rest of the city, but you don't quite know why, and you might not even ask why. The way it's run, it has about 10,000 people live in the Square Mile, but about 500,000 people come in every day. The way that the mayor is elected is voted on by the people who live there, which is a tiny number of people. The guilds, there's so much to say about the Square Mile.
And what pictures did you take?
So I did it from an outsider's perspective. I would go and photograph street scenes, and then sometimes I would, because I photographed it over 12 years, so sometimes I would get involved in the Lord. I'd been into the Lord Mayor's office, spent time with various Lord Mayors there. I would photograph protests. I would photograph after big events like the London Bridge bomb.
Oh, so a bit of your old guardian type attitude crept in there.
Well, I'm just intrigued by the Square Mile. So whatever feels relevant, I would go and photograph it over the years.
And having done that, you then went back during lockdown when nobody was working there.
Yes. So I have 2 kids, and during lockdown they had to do their schoolwork, but we were allowed an hour a day, so I would get up before the kids and cycle into town with my camera early mornings, have an hour to myself, and then yeah, just photograph the empty streets.
Yeah, and was there anything you discovered, you know, without the people?
Well, I think you got really clear views and really clear, how it's incredible. The Bank of England with nobody around it, with the light coming up in the morning, you could just see all the lines in it. Yeah, like you'll never see it like that again.
You talk about light. I always think that photographers need a lot of patience because they spend a lot of time waiting for the light to be absolutely perfect.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the nice thing about doing long projects is, I mean, I know the city really well now. I could tell you where the sun comes at what point and which, you know, where the reflection off some glass hits. So there's one of my empty street, empty London, the Lockdown London series, which is a building with gold windows, and the gold reflects off onto this other building at a certain time of the day. So you get the blue of the background buildings, the brick buildings, and the gold reflecting down the street.
You have mentioned that you look for small, often unconscious gestures of your subjects. What sort of things did you mean by that?
Well, I think it's about eye contact. It's about touch. It's about interconnected feelings that you see, I guess. So, for example, in Holding the Baby, I was with a woman who was with her son, and her daughter was sitting right next to her, all curled up next to her. And at one moment, she reaches out to touch her son's back. But that felt very significant because the distance that her son was starting to pull, was starting to feel to his mother because he's turning into a teenager, and she was still reaching out to him. So, and that felt like a moment of sort of pain for her that he's going, but for him, you know, also he would need that touch. Yeah, so moments like that.
I mean, they can't come around too often, those sorts of things, can they?
That's why you need time.
Yeah. Let's talk about your current exhibition, Leaving Ukraine, where you've taken a few people who have had to leave for various reasons because of the war. One of the subjects you chose was a young girl called Liena. And Liena came and stayed with you, didn't she?
That's right. I first met Liena in Moldova in March 2022. And she had left Mykolaiv a few weeks before. And Mykolaiv is in the south of Ukraine.
And what were you doing in Moldova?
So I decided to make a project about people who had left Ukraine because I saw people going over the borders, and because of martial law, it was all women and children, or old people, but women, not the men. And so I thought I would try to find some people to follow. I presumed for a year, because I presumed the war would... I think, you know, all Ukrainians were thinking it was just going to be a few months of maybe a year, and then that I would go back with them and photograph them at the end. So I wrote to lots of organisations, charities, Médecins Sans Frontières, all the people who were on the front line, and asked if I could come and meet them and meet people that they were working with. So I flew to Moldova, Chisinau, and went to stay with a charity called Fides, and Liena was there. Fides was housing about 120 Ukrainians, and they introduced me to some people, and I met Liena. She was living in a dormitory with her mum, her then fiancé's family, and three grandparents. And then the room was getting fuller and fuller over the week that I was there. By the end, there were 16 people in this room. And she was a law graduate, 21 years old, very bright, and she was just sitting around with nothing to do. She didn't know if she was going to go forward, keep moving away from Ukraine, or go back to Ukraine. She was telling me at the time that she thought she'd be there for a couple of weeks, and then she would go back. So when I left, I stayed in contact with her.
Did you manage at that time to photograph the anxiety she was feeling?
Well, it was interesting, actually. So I went in to meet her, and we sat down and chatted, and I took a few pictures of her. And I recently was chatting to her about it, and she said, "Polly, it was so weird when you came in to chat to us," because her and Masha, the sister of her fiancé, spoke English. The charity was sending lots of journalists to come and speak to them. And she said, each journalist would come in and they wanted us to tell the story of crying and being a refugee. And you just sat and chatted to us without an agenda. And I don't know, I didn't have to send my work off to the wires at the end of the day. I didn't have to get a refugee story. I could just find out what was going on with them. It's a different role.
But how come she ended up in London then?
So Moldova started to get quite dangerous. Moldova has a very small army, about 2,000 people, and it's not protected by NATO. So, and it has a Russian separatist group in the north of Moldova. And it looked like it was possibly going to be attacked a few months into the war. And Liena and her mum, we were in contact by this point, said that they wanted to leave. And they were planning to go to Italy. They had some relative who knew someone in Italy. And so at that point, I said to Liena and her mum, look, would you like to come and stay with me on the Homes for Ukraine scheme? I've got room and you could come. And Liena called me back the next day. She said, actually, mum wants to go to Italy because her mum is a sign language interpreter on the news. There's a sign language group in Italy and she in Pisa, and she hopes that they will help her get work eventually. But I'd like to come. So she went to Mantova with her mum and waited for her UK visa. And then a few weeks later, she got the visa and she came to London.
Did her mother stay in Italy?
So Liena's story, if you saw it from the outside quickly, could look like this fairy tale story. Because what happened was she came here, she got a job in a law firm, Vibo Rein, and then she met someone new. They got married last August and she had a baby this January. So it could look like this fairy tale story of, and it kind of is, but...
Well, it's not for the fiancé she left in Ukraine.
I mean, she was 21, so I guess, yeah, she would say, you know, she was young.
But it's not a fairy tale, are you saying
well,
that?
Well, it's not a straightforward fairy tale, because her mum, in the meantime, went to Italy, and she was living in... So all the Ukrainians from Mantova, when they were living, were told one day that they were closing the whole support from Mantova, they were shutting, and they all had to get on a coach, and they were being driven to Pavia. But as they drove towards Pavia, they said, actually, we're not going to Pavia, we're going to a small town called Salice Terme, and you're all going to be living in a hotel. And this was from one day to the next. And the hotel was not a functioning hotel, it was just an empty building with a corridor. And they were, first of all, they had a room each, but after 2 weeks, a whole new group of people came from Nigeria, refugees from Nigeria, and they all had to bunk up. So they had four people in each room. And they were bought food by the organisation, but they couldn't choose their food. And they had a kitchen where they could cook, but there were 40 or so Ukrainians in this hotel. There was no prospect of work because it's a sleepy holiday town. And they were given €2.50 a day. And so Liena's mum was really deteriorating mental health-wise, and Liena was feeling really worried about her. She also carried a lot of guilt about leaving.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That must be a common thing.
Yeah, I think it must be a really common thing. She felt like, why had she been so lucky? And the war was still going on, and she really wanted to concentrate on pushing forward, on creating her life, on putting down roots and securing something. She has no... Her father died when she was 13, so there's no family backup. But she had this terrible guilt about her mother. And her mother actually, in the end, returned to Ukraine because she couldn't find work in Italy. She was there for a year. And she's now back in Mykolaiv as a sign language interpreter on the news.
Oh, right. And is it reasonably safe there?
Well, Mykolaiv... there was two missile attacks on the weekend, so... It's reasonably safe, but it is very close to Kharkiv and,
Before I go, I must ask you about Gaza. Mm. We've all seen the awful situation that's developing there. You have experience of Gaza, don't you?
Yeah.
So it must have an extra resonance for you.
I went in when Rantisi was killed. I went in and did a story there for The Guardian. And then I ended up going back four times. And there's a lovely fixer, and I've been in contact. He's alive and his family's alive. They're up in Rafah. But I think about all the fishermen that I was with. It was 20 years ago.
You went out fishing with them, did you?
I went out fishing with the fishermen overnight, and they were shot at all night by an Israeli warship.
Why was that? We're talking some years ago now.
20 years ago. So the situation for fishermen was that I thought it was an amazing story because on the coast of Gaza there's a sea, and I thought, wow, at least there's some freedom in the sea. Already by then you had to go through long tunnels to get out of Gaza and through lots of security to get in and out. And in actual fact, the fishermen, they go out a fleet of 30 boats, small one big boat and 29 small boats, and they get themselves into a circle in order to fish. But they're only allowed to go out 3 kilometres out to sea. And if they go beyond 3 kilometres, the Israeli warship that is patrolling the waters fires taser bullets over their heads, but sometimes they get hit. But they were using, 20 years ago, they were using this tiny sat-nav to see how far out to sea they'd gone, and only one man had the sat-nav. So every time they went beyond the 3 kilometre border, bearing in mind they're trying to catch fish, so of course they wanted to go further out because then you'd catch more fish, and their fishing trawls were getting less and less fish they were catching each time. They came home with some small crates of sardines, and these bullets flew over our head all night.
And do you happen to know if they are still fishing? Because, my goodness, they need the fish.
I know. I don't know.
But it must, having seen it, it must feel awful for you.
Really awful. Shocking to watch.
Anyway, what else are you working on now? Because I know your projects go on for several years sometimes, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm finishing a body of work about people with learning disabilities and housing.
I've seen a picture that you've taken of Millicent, I think it is, holding 2 keys, and I just wondered what that was.
Well, that was about getting a new home, yeah. Mm. This is about getting independent living. So not necessarily having been homeless, but having not had independent living before. It's about moving people out into the community, into your own.
People with learning difficulties.
People with learning disabilities,
right.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that, Polly, and thanks very much for telling all those wonderful stories.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Polly Braden, and as usual, I've put all the photos we talked about there on the Considering Art website. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Chondy. See you next week.